And if you're eager to really get on with summer, we have an encouraging sign today. The U.S. Coast Guard says it's officially halted ice-breaking operations for the season. They've been at it for 4 months, according to reports. Final operations were on Monday. They focused on keeping vessels moving around the Great Lakes, the St. Mary's River, the Detroit River, and, of course, the Mackinac Straits. Summer in Michigan is 3 months of poor sledding, as they say. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR. We're on every day at noon on AM 870 as well, and we're always at WKAR.org. Ask a five-year-old what they want to be when they grow up, and chances are you'll hear things like a doctor or a teacher or maybe Batman. Obviously, not many kids grow up to be Batman, but increasingly there are also fewer and fewer growing up to be teachers. Across the country and here in Michigan, the number of students choosing to go into teaching preparation programs is declining. A recent article by Detroit Free Press reporter Lori Higgins found the number of Michigan students in teacher preparation programs declined by 38% from 2008 to 2013. That's left some schools scrambling to fill positions, especially in areas like foreign language and the STEM fields. To learn more about what might be ahead and what might be behind the decline and how it could impact schools in our state, I talked to Don Heller, Dean of the College of Education here at Michigan State University. I started by asking him just how steep a decline Michigan State has seen in recent years.
Well, we've seen over the last decade, the last 10 years or so, we've seen a decline about 18% overall in our teacher prep enrollments. And that's mirroring a trend that we're seeing around the country as well as the other institutions here in Michigan as well.
How's the college responding to that?
Well, one of the things we're trying to do is we're trying a little bit to try to recruit students a little bit more proactively. We were in the mode before of letting students come to us and find us, but we are trying to recruit more proactively. We're trying to get the word out there about what a teaching career is, what it means, what the rewards are, both to students who are already here at Michigan State and have not yet chosen a major, but also to students who are in high school who may be thinking about a teaching career.
So when you encounter a student considering teaching as a career, how do you make them more enthused about that idea?
Well, you know, one of the things we try to sell prospective students on, Mark, is that teaching can be a very, very rewarding career. You know, you have the opportunity every single day to shape children's lives and to really shape the path that they're going to be on the rest of their lives. So we really try to play up what those rewards are and the impact that people can have on children's lives. That's really the most important reward in teaching. You know, nobody's going to get rich becoming a teacher. You're not going to become famous. It's really the rewards you get every day in working with children and being able to improve their lives. That's what we try to impress on our prospective students, what they can be doing in a career as a teacher.
Let's talk a little bit about what might be behind this decline, though. Do you have any evidence that points to particular causes?
You know, we don't have any true evidence that we can apportion the reason why students are, you know, not becoming teachers as much as they used to in the past. But we've got a number of reasons that we believe are behind it. You know, first of all, part of it in Michigan, at least, is just demographics. You know, there are, if you go back over the last decade, really takes us back to the prior recession. It's been very difficult fiscal times for school districts around Michigan, and they just haven't been doing as much hiring as they had been back in the 80s and the 90s when it was still boom times. The second factor is that charters have certainly made inroads here in Michigan. Michigan, by some measures, is the largest charter school state in the nation, and most of our students here at Michigan State are interested in careers in public schools. So the fact that charters have been growing more rapidly in Michigan, I think, has probably dissuaded a lot of students from becoming teachers. And, you know, part of it, Mark, we believe is just the overall attacks on teachers and schools and the teaching profession that have been going on in this country by the media, by policymakers. And we think that has an impact on the interest that students may have in becoming teachers.
Well, educators have had to deal with changing standards and increased testing. Has the shift to the Common Core curriculum had any impact?
I don't think the shift to the Common Core by itself has dissuaded people from becoming teachers. What's probably more of an impact is all of the focus, you know, on testing and standardized testing in schools that's been going on in the country now for over a dozen years since No Child Left Behind was passed during the first Bush administration. When you talk to teachers, they'll tell you that they believe they have much less autonomy in how they can run their classrooms, control of the curriculum, that they did before No Child Left Behind. And that word gets out there, and we think that has dissuaded dissuaded some people from becoming teachers.
How do you deal with that, though, with a public that apparently wants more accountability from the teaching profession?
Well, it's a challenge because certainly accountability is important. If you ask any teacher, you ask the teachers' unions, they will agree that accountability is important. But I think there's some very good disagreement over how accountability should be used in schools. And there are a lot of people who believe that the focus on standardized tests really is not the only way we should be measuring schools, be measuring teachers, be measuring students, and that there are other ways we can do that.
Don Heller is the Dean of the College of Education at Michigan State University. We're talking about the declining number of Michigan students choosing to go into teacher preparation program, and that mirrors a national trend, actually. A recent Detroit Free Press article from Lori Higgins mentioned that special education and foreign languages are two areas that could see future shortages because of this decline in students choosing teaching. Are there specialties or certain age groups, let's say, that are seeing particularly noticeable shortages?
Yeah, you know, we hold a recruitment fair every spring over at the Breslin Center, Mark, and we have, this year we had 165 school districts from around the country, in fact, around the world, who are here to recruit our graduates. And one of the things I do every year is I go around and I talk to the recruiters, and these are usually principals, human resource directors, and I say, what is it you're looking for? Because it's important for us to know what the future demand is going to be for teachers. Very consistently, in almost every single school district around the country, they tell you they need special education teachers, foreign language teachers, and teachers in science and math in the STEM areas. That's very consistent, and that's where we're concerned that there are going to be shortages. The good news for us is that special education is the one program we have where our enrollments are actually up over the last decade.
In general, how would you characterize the public's perception of teachers? Is it possible to generalize on that, or maybe generalize on how it's changed?
Well, it is difficult to generalize, but one of the things that's pretty consistent in the polling is that when you ask people about the state of education in this country and about teachers and the teaching profession, you do hear a lot of criticism, and that criticism is probably stronger than it was a decade or two ago. But interestingly enough, when you ask people to talk about their own local schools that their children attend and their teachers, people are usually very complimentary about the local schools and the local teachers. So it's that, you know, conundrum that we have to deal with, that overall there's a lot of criticism about education, and yet people tend to be fairly satisfied with their local schools and teachers.
Has the economic climate in Michigan over the past, since the Great Recession, let's say, has that impacted the perception of teaching as a stable job?
Well, I think it's probably only gotten better in the last few years as we've come out of the recession here in the state. So, you know, certainly the economy has turned around. State funding for K-12 schools has started to pick up a little bit. So I think the outlook is a little bit better. We expect that there's going to be a lot of teachers who are in the baby boomer generation who perhaps were postponing retirement during the recession, who in the next 5 years will probably start to retire. That'll help create more openings. So we're pretty optimistic that all of these things together are going to make for a better teacher job market here in Michigan, and that we hope will also attract more students into our teacher preparation programs.
I know Superintendent Flanagan has said he thinks teachers should be paid a lot more. I think he may have said $100,000 a year or so. Do you think paying teachers more and making the career more economically attractive would make a difference?
Well, it certainly couldn't hurt. It has to help. But when you ask most teachers, they'll tell you that their salary is not the most important factor in their career satisfaction or in the particular school in which they're working. It will help, but most teachers are also very concerned about the working conditions. And as I said earlier, this focus on standardized testing and how much autonomy they have in the classroom, or whether they're doing nothing but skilling and drilling students for the tests. But I agree with Superintendent Flanagan, raising teacher salaries should help to draw more people and more qualified people into the profession as well.
What kinds of consequences do you expect to see from this decline in enrollment? Do you anticipate a serious teacher shortage at some point?
Certainly in some areas, in particular areas such as the ones I mentioned before, special education, foreign language, STEM areas. We may face some shortages, particularly as we see retirements of more experienced teachers. Overall, it appears that even with the decline in enrollments in teacher prep programs in Michigan, which is down about a little over a third in the last decade statewide, even with that larger decline, there are some areas where we still appear to be producing plenty of teachers, such as elementary education, high school English, and social studies. But those shortage areas could really come to hurt the state if we're not able to attract more students into those programs.
What kind of consequences do you see for Michigan school students?
Well, if you know you don't have qualified teachers in the classroom, teachers who are certified in the subject that they're supposed to be teaching, that ultimately is going to harm the quality of instructions for students in our schools. So that could be a particularly difficult issue if those shortages continue down the road in some of these critical need areas.
How do you make a difference when it comes to students maybe having a negative perception of teaching, the young people themselves? What can be done to make students look at it as an attractive career option again?
Well, that is a challenge, because especially by the time children get to high school, where they may be reading the newspaper and reading about some of the attacks on schools and teachers, it can be difficult to overcome that perception. But one of the things we do in our college is that we have a summer program for high school students. We bring about 75 students every summer for either 2 or 4 weeks to our campus, mostly from Detroit and Grand Rapids. And part of the purpose of that program is to try to enculturate them and get them interested in teaching as a career for themselves. So they're here, they have instruction from our teachers, they have instruction from our doctoral students. We talk to them about what it means to be a teacher, what the rewards are of being a teacher. And we hope that a program like this helps to get them excited about the possibility of becoming a teacher and ultimately returning to their communities and contributing to their schools.
Don Heller is dean of MSU's College of Education. We're talking about how the declining number of students entering the teaching career could have an impact on education in Michigan. Should lawmakers be paying closer attention to these declining enrollments?
I think so. I think the legislature certainly plays an important role. Funding is probably more important than anything else right now. Even though we've seen some increases in K-12 funding in the last few years, we're still well below where we were 10 years ago in the state funding per student that is going into school districts. So the state has a long ways to go to recover its funding and be able to provide adequate resources, particularly schools in the more challenging parts of the state, the urban areas, the more rural areas. Those are the ones where we really have to look at the funding and whether it's adequate to provide a good, strong education for their students.
We're a few months into a new legislature here in Michigan. What do you make of the broader conversation involving education at the state capitol, let's say?
Well, it's a little bit too early to tell where this legislature is going to go. They haven't spent too much time on many substantive issues in education. They have expressed a little bit of willingness to increase funding, a very small amount. You know, certainly the voting down of Proposal 1 isn't going to help schools. There would have been more funding for schools if that had passed. But it's still, I think, the jury is out on what kind of substantive areas besides funding the current legislature is going to tackle.
Don Heller is the dean of Michigan State University's College of Education. We've been talking about the declining number of Michigan students choosing to go into teacher preparation programs and teaching as a career. Dean Heller, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Dozens of bird lovers have journeyed to Lansing's Potter Park recently to view the area's first nesting bald eagles in decades. The nest sits in a large tree in a marshy area in the middle of the Red Cedar River. What's the likelihood that the birds could make that area a permanent home? Well, our next guest is giving that a lot of thought. In fact, biologist Christopher Hull thinks the eagles have abandoned that nest. One of Mr. Hull's specialties is ornithology and habitat. He's viewed the nest and the eagles a number of times, and he wrote an op-ed that you may have read in the Lansing State Journal a week or 10 days or so ago, and Christopher Hull joins us now. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You viewed the nest for a while yesterday. Why don't we'll start with an update there. Did you see an eagle yesterday?
No. Okay. I talked to a number of people who were over there, and I didn't talk to anybody who'd seen them for about 2 days.
When was the last time you saw a bald eagle there?
Well, the last time I saw one there was on Monday, which was the day after the agencies involved altered the site
did some cutting, yeah. We'll get into that here in just a second. I finally made it to the site last night.
Oh, did you?
Did not see the eagle. But it's funny how anecdotal this all is, because you go there and almost invariably you run into other people.
Right.
You find out that somebody saw it yesterday, and indeed one person that was there last night at the site saw it yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Another saw it the day before. You've indicated that you think the birds may have abandoned the nest. Why do you think that?
Well, I've been monitoring the eagles since actually the time that they pretty much showed up in the area. Now, we have eagles in Lansing essentially every year along the river systems. Bald eagles in Michigan winter along river corridors, especially in southern Michigan.
Including the Lansing area?
Oh, yes. Yes. We get them on just about every Christmas bird count every year, somewhere in the Grand River system. Oftentimes, it's right around Potter Park. I've gotten them down by Jolly Road and Dunkel and the Bear Lake Bog area. And they hang out just about every year. They're seen at the MSU Water Quality Ponds, which is on the south side of Jolly Road.
But this is the first time we've got an actual nest. Is that correct? That's the first.
Those are wintering individuals. Often they're immatures. Sometimes they're adults. And, adults from way far north are migratory. The immatures are migratory. And so they'll come down in the winter because they find open water, because they feed primarily on fish and waterfowl.
But why do you think the nest here that a pair did take up here, I guess, in February at first?
Correct.
Why do you think they've abandoned that nest?
Well, they began, first of all, we'll just cut to the chase here as far as abandonment. On Sunday, Potter Park had apparently, according to a Potter Park spokesperson that I spoke with, had collaborated with a couple of agencies, Fish and Wildlife Service and DNR, and according to this person, they had signed off on the park cutting some tree limbs, which formed really a boundary around the swamp and kind of formed a visual screen between the nest and the main parking area of Potter Park. Now, their stated reasoning for doing this was that this would give people a better viewing platform of the eagles, and somehow they reasoned that was going to serve as an alternate way for people to look at them other than canoeing and kayaking in there, that somehow this was supposed to stop people from boating in there. And I tried to explain to her that, you know, the people boating in there may not have anything to do with the eagles. They're putting in far away from the park, and they're canoeing in there. And at any rate, the things just didn't match. But it seemed very clear to me that they were kind of trying to build an attraction there and allow for viewing. Now, what that did was, what they were doing is they were going into the swamp with boats and chainsaws and climbing up into this large tree and lopping down two huge limbs and then some smaller limbs so that people could have a clear visual shot. Well, that was also going to give a clear visual shot from the female on the nest right to the parking lot and vice versa. And I missed the female departing the nest, but I asked a number of people there, including this Potter Park spokesperson, did you see two eagles? Were there two eagles here? And they said, yes, there was one on the nest that flew and, you know, and fled the area. And the other one, which turned out to be the male, of course, was basically perched back in the swamp watching the entire proceeding.
You think the chainsawing and the elimination of the cover caused the eagles to abandon the nest then?
Well, I think that's ultimately was the straw that broke the camel's back. But now I'll backtrack a little bit to something else. I'm not going to blame these agencies for causing the failure of the nest. They caused the abandonment of the nest. They brought it about, but it was just the final straw. Because what had really happened is the eagles, apparently by all indications that I have from my observations, began incubating on February 8th. And that's absolutely right in line with when eagles around this latitude normally begin egg laying. And so they began incubation then. And if you do the math, if you use even the wildest exaggerated date ranges for incubation ranges, and even if you build in a fudge factor for, you know, maybe they, you know, they didn't start quite when I thought they did, they still should have hatched young by mid to late March, absolutely April 1st at the latest.
And no one's seen any young
since
then.
There's been no sign of young at all. And so what will happen with birds, any birds that have eggs that don't hatch, they will continue to incubate and continue and continue and continue. Eventually, they give it up. So these eggs were a month and a half overdue, and so the female was just essentially at the end of her rope anyway. And this was, like I said, the final straw.
So where do you think, where is the smart money on where these eagles are now? Could they still stay in the Lansing area? Could they still stay near Potter Park?
Well, you know, I was surprised.
If you're right, assuming you're right.
Assuming I'm right. I invite anybody to provide anything concrete to contradict it, but I'm kind of surprised at the way the females so abruptly departed. But I suspect, you know, she's got to be somewhere. I suspect that she's back in the swamp someplace, and the male was hanging around for a couple of days, and he'll just perch near the nest. And, you know, they have bonds that they develop, and it takes a while for them to sort of redirect those. And for the female, you know, she did it. The male is sort of transitioning, I think, from being a mated male with a nest, and he's still lingering near the nest. His sight, it's what we call sight tenacity, you know, how easily, what is it, what will a bird endure to cling to a given nest?
Mm-hmm. But what are the odds that they'll stay in the Lansing area?
I think they're good. I mean, you know, the Potter Park and the Grand River system basically have everything they need. If birds can winter here in the winter, obviously, you know, they can live here year-round. Their tolerance for people has been such that they've been able to exist. But, you know, when you get into nesting, you get into a higher standard of habitat quality. They need more seclusion. They need more distance. And, you know, it may be that Potter Park is not going to, you know, be able to support them given the amount of invasion and stuff. Now, the question is, people are always asking me, you think they'll use the same nest again? They may or may not. The site alteration might have been too drastic for the female. The female is the less tolerant of the two, and so that's why I keep talking about the female. The male and the female actually share nest duties about equally. So, you know, and as it was so many animals, including, you know, we might say Homo sapiens, you know, the female calls the shots. So there are more remote places they could nest in Potter Park Swamp. They could go over to Crego Park over there because mm-hmm. there's plenty of that. That's quite a lot of solitude over there.
They are covering quite an area. Some of the folks that were there at the site with me last night pointed out they've seen them near the Sycamore Golf Course, up and down Mount Hope, sometimes on the wing. We want to thank our guest biologist Christopher Hall, who's keeping a close eye on the bald eagles that he believes have abandoned their nest on the Red Cedar River in Potter Park. Chris Hall, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on Current State, researchers at Michigan State University who study the impact of jobs and the impact they have on health have released their annual report on workplace deaths. The good news is the number of workplace deaths in Michigan is decreasing. The bad news is the number of workplace homicides is actually up. Melissa Benmark joins us in a minute. And the fifth annual Mighty Uke Day is this Friday through Sunday in Old Town. We'll talk with founder Ben Hassinger and hear a little uke and bass from Ben and Steve Zalige. That and more after the break.
from the moment you wake up through the chaos of your busy morning. Morning Edition is there with you.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Protesters have been
through all you have to do, we'll bring you all you need to know every weekday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Listen every morning on the way to work between 5 and 9 on 90.5 WKAR.
For keeping on top of the news.
You're listening to the BBC World Service.
I'm Robin Lustig.
I'm Julian Marshall.
This is Owen Bennett-Jones
with NewsHour.
For finding out what's happened.
They're out on the stage, the protest leaders, still trying to rally their supporters.
And for knowing why it's happened.
They've often then turned to the Taliban as another way of earning a living.
Stay in touch with the world with NewsHour from the BBC.
This afternoon at 4 on AM 870 WKAR.
Little bit from the Lansing folk band The Barred Owls there, who joined us here in Studio S live last February. Tomorrow we'll be bringing you another Live Music Friday with Jackalope, a Lansing area band with its roots in classic Americana. Jackalope tomorrow on Current State's Live Music Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR. Workers Memorial Day. That is a day. Workers' Memorial Day was last week in the United States, and if you've never heard of it, it's something labor unions worldwide conceived to raise consciousness about fatalities on the job. And WKAR's Melissa Benmark has more. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. This week also, news of a Detroit man crushed to death in a stamping plant accident. So these things are close to home. Mm. There are about 5,000 workplace deaths around the country each year. Michigan State University actually has a role in keeping track of the ones that occur in Michigan. Kenneth Rosenman is a professor in MSU's College of Human Medicine and is connected to the Michigan Fatality Assessment and Control Evaluation Program. And I asked him about what exactly that is.
So this is a research program funded by the Centers for Disease Control and the section within the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. And we investigate the people who die acutely from a trauma at work. So this is not looking at people who may develop a cancer or a chronic disease, but people who get electrocuted, fall off a scaffold, an explosion, and so we're investigating these deaths that occur each year in Michigan with the idea of trying to prevent them. These deaths are preventable, and so it's what we call this root cause investigations to look at, you know, what were the underlying cause of why this happened? Was it an engineering? Was it a policy issue? With the idea then, after we investigate them, to get the word out to other people, other industries, other companies doing the same type of work, and prevent, you know, these from occurring in the future.
Now, what is your role in all this?
So I'm the principal investigator, the person who actually goes out in the field and does the investigations is Deborah Chester, and she's an industrial hygienist here at the university. I get to review her reports and make suggestions on sort of educational campaigns and write some of the material. She's the one who actually does the legwork.
So one of the things that caught my attention was that it sounds like workplace homicides are up, even though workplace deaths are decreasing in Michigan. And the first thing that popped into my mind was, do you mean like disgruntled former employees or people, you know, killed in the course of robberies and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so it's mainly people killed in the course of robberies. I'm just looking over the list so far. You know, there are a couple that are, you know, there's one here, somebody after an argument with an employee, but we're mainly talking about sort of people who've had no connection with the person killed. You know, we have police officers killed at a, you know, gunshot wounds at a traffic stop, yeah, in the line of duty homicides.
Is there a particular profession that seems to be most at risk for workplace homicides?
You know, there over half of them occur in retail situations. And then you have the issues with firefighters and a security guard. We had a firefighter die because of an intentionally set fire. So that is actually considered a homicide.
Right.
But retail is, just about half, 52%, is slightly more than half related to retail.
One of the things that crosses my mind, though, with retail is that, in general, these are folks who, maybe can't say anything about being put on by themselves late at night or early on in the morning. They're not a high leverage group
Correct.
Of employees in general. So how does this situation get changed for the better for them?
And if you really think about it, fatalities are really, the tip of the iceberg, or we talk about a disease pyramid. So fatalities, I'm going to answer your question. Fatalities are just, a very small percentage. We have about 350,000 Michigan workers each year injured at work. It's really, we have every 2 days, three people have parts of their finger or a whole finger amputated. Every day, there are 5 work-related burns. Every day, 8 people get hospitalized with work-related injuries. So it's really sort of this tip of this disease pyramid. And I just think that's, and really what determines whether people get injured or die is the workplace culture. And so we have some employers who are very safety-oriented, and they understand it's important to prevent these fatalities, to prevent injuries, and they will get online and read about it. They'll have health and safety committees. They'll do educational things for the employees, and they're very, they see that. And then you have other employers who don't have that same level of safety culture. So, I guess my first response to your question is, you want to work for an employer who's got that safety culture, who's insistent on doing the right thing and following, and setting the workplace so it's safe. Employees can bring, now with the internet, if you can Google workplace violence, and there is a lot out there on the right way to do it. So, ideally, the employee can bring that to their employer's attention, and maybe talk about, hey, forget my safety. You wouldn't say it that way, but hey, you want to protect so you don't get robbed? Because it's sort of the same issue.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about protecting, your money here, depending on your employer. But you're right. We're talking about people who may not have, have a lot of power at work and yet maybe trying to sell it in a different way to their employer if they work for an employer who doesn't have that safety culture.
One thing I also noticed was that agriculture now has the third highest rate of workplace death. And isn't that kind of a shift? Because it seemed to me there was a time when farming tool and farming machinery accidents were a lot bigger in Michigan than that.
Yes. So, farming has never had the top number because, construction has had. But, yes, the rates have come down in farming. We've put a lot of effort into that. The Michigan Farm Bureau has put a lot of effort into that. Michigan OSHA has funded educational work sessions for farmers. Some of the causes of death in farmers is the lack of rollover protection on tractors, and one way or the other, those tractors are aging that don't have it and are being brought out of service. So we're seeing less tractors. We're seeing less rollover-related tractor deaths. So yes, that is a good trend, and we're happy to see that trend, and it's good that you recognized it.
How do we do as a state in terms of workplace deaths nationwide? Where are we?
We do well. We actually have, lower rates of death in general for work-related deaths. And, we have an active Michigan OSHA program. We have a number of large employers who are, very active, with safety culture. We have unions that have active health and safety programs. So we actually, overall, if you look at the rates of work-related deaths, we do better than the rest of the country.
So then, as a nation, about 5,000 workplace deaths a year.
Correct.
Obviously, you can't compare the United States with, some of the third world areas of the world. But in terms of other industrialized countries as well, does that seem like a large number of deaths or not so much?
Yeah, it is. It's a large number if you compare us to the European countries. Part of the issue is, it seems sort of, no big deal trying to figure out how many occur, but it's a very actually complicated process, and that's actually part of the things we do is count, just trying to figure out who it is that is dying, because, how do you find that out? And so if you go to an African country, you're not going to be able to get that. I mean, here when we do that, we use newspaper clippings and there's some requirements for employers to report to OSHA, and we have medical examiners, and we have systems related to transportation and the state police. But if you look at the Europeans who have similar, they have the infrastructure to do the counts, we don't do as well as particularly the Scandinavian countries, which have they're much more into sort of engineering changes and that's the key thing. If you can engineer out the issue, and so they do much better job at engineering out some of the hazards. They're much more structured in terms of requiring health and safety committees, and so the Europeans do better than we do.
Well, Dr. Kenneth Rosenman, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate
it. Thanks. I hope your cold gets better.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Current State, three times daily on 90.5 WKAR and AM 870 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. These days, readers have their pick of books about post-apocalyptic worlds, but if you can choose only one, our book reviewer Scott Southard says you might want to consider Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel.
These days, it seems, every writer, producer, and director out there wants to say something about the apocalypse. Whether it's a TV show full of zombies or a movie about an alien invasion, you just can't seem to escape the end of the world. Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel is also about the end of life as we know it, but don't let that deter you. This book is about more than just survival and desperation. It's about humanity itself. Station 11 has received praise both from critics and readers. It was a National Book Award finalist and one of this year's Michigan Notable Books. It's also been selected as the 2015 Great Michigan Read. Sponsored by the Michigan Humanities Council, the program wants to get everyone from young adult readers to senior citizens excited about reading. And this year's selection is sure to do that. At the heart of Station 11 is a group of musicians and actors that call themselves the Traveling Symphony. They are a ragtag caravan that moves along the coast of Lake Michigan performing Shakespeare and Beethoven to the few surviving communities. These scattered settlements are all that remains of the world after a deadly flu wipes out 99% of the population. Sometimes the performers are welcomed with open arms, and sometimes they are chased off with guns. One of the main protagonists in this epic novel is an actress in the symphony. We first meet Kirsten as a young girl playing the role of one of King Lear's daughters in a performance in Toronto right before the pandemic hits. Her life after the flu has not been an easy one. Like everyone else in the symphony, Kirsten has lost her family. She's also had to make some tough and violent decisions to survive, as signaled by the two tattoos of knives on her wrist. But despite her losses, Kirsten still manages to find joy in the work of the great bard. While she is only one member of a very large cast, in many ways Kirsten represents the spirit of Mandel's powerful novel. Yes, Station 11 has conflicts and terrors. It even has a villain called the Prophet with a fanatical following. Luckily for us, though, Mandel wrote more than a simple adventure. Instead, she managed to create a book that says something about what makes humanity special. No zombies needed. There is something glorious about the idea that even at the end, the arts survive, still defining what it means to be human. That's what makes Station 11 stand out from other apocalyptic tales. Hope. Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel deserves all the accolades it's received. It's a brilliant book. And if Mandel is right, and art survives after the end, my hope is Station 11 will be there as well. A reminder of the power of the arts to inspire, even in the face of adversity. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Scott Southard is the author of the new novel Permanent Spring Showers and A Jane Austen Daydream. You can follow his writing on his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. You'll find that at sdsouthard.com. Well, Mighty Uke Day 5 is Friday through Sunday in Old Town Lansing. It's promoted as a celebration of the diminutive yet dynamic instrument and its ties to Michigan culture? We've got to find out more about that. There will be performances by professionals and opportunities for beginners to try their hand at playing the ukulele this weekend. Current State welcomes back Ben Hassinger to Studio S. Ben is the organizer of Mighty Uke Day, and he's brought along fellow musician Steve Zalaji to play some music for us. Before we learn more about Mighty Uke Day, let's hear some music. Ben Hassinger, Steve Zalaji here with Ben's song, Uke and Me.
And me, inseparable, happy, undeniable, you can be. I'm over the moon, in love with you. Four strings, dark mahogany, roll rings, endless possibilities, you can me. We're gonna go places together. I never thought that I could ever make music so fine. But the minute I cradled you in my arms, I knew that you were mine. Never thought I could ever make music so fine. But the minute I cradled you in my arms, I knew that you were mine. All mine, you can be. Inseparable, happy, undeniable, you can be. Gonna go places. Together we're going places. Together, you can be. Oh, you can be. You can be.
Hey, nice. Ben Hassinger and Steve Zalaji here on Current State as we learn more here about Mighty Uke Day with Ben and Steve. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having us.
We have you guys on here every year, so we're becoming kind of a Uke destination here on your radio. I know you officially get started with a strum at the Capitol at noon tomorrow, but I understand that you informally launched this thing with a ukulele flash mob.
Ooh, boy, was that fun.
A ukulele flash mob on a CATA bus? That
yeah.
sounds dangerous. How did that
well,
work out?
Well, you know, I arrange it with the CATA has a program called CATA Acts of Culture, and they try to promote cultural events in the city. And we started off at the Meridian Mall, and we got about five of us on the bus, on the number one bus, and picked up more riders along the way. And by the time we got downtown, we had about 35 people on the bus singing and playing, got off the bus, and we went over to the Exchange and played a few songs with the Scorioki Band.
And did you just explode into action in the middle of this bus? And people are just riding the bus and all
yeah,
of a sudden?
Yeah, people got on the bus and they were kind of looking around and going, what is this? And once they settled in, everybody pretty much enjoyed it except for one woman who had her hands over her ears. So I apologize to her, but
were
it
you
was
a,
fun.
Steve, were you a part of this flash mob or were you not?
I showed up at the Exchange later on and played bass with the folks there playing ukulele with Mike Scurry.
Okay. Once again, it's Mighty Uke Day, this Mighty Uke Day 5 here this weekend, actually, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in Old Town. Organizer Ben Hassinger and fellow musician Steve Zalige joins us. Now, the strum is at the Capitol at noon tomorrow. Can
right.
anybody with a ukulele
yeah,
come along?
Yeah, anybody shows
and just...
up. We're going to start at noon, and Andy Shore is going to give us a proclamation from the state of Michigan, Representative Shore. And what we're going to do is... play about a half hour of songs, and if you go to mightyukeday.com, you can actually download the songs in advance and show up and play along with us, and then we'll have a little Mighty Uke Day parade down to Old Town Lansing where all the festivities go on for the weekend.
And I understand down there you were you have an instrument that you think may be the world's largest ukulele?
It is the mightiest of Mighty Ukes. Larry Stump from Diamonddale, who's the father of Ruben Stump, who's a young man that's been with the Lansing Area Ukulele Group since he was 8. Now he's like 14 or something. His dad built a 13-foot-tall ukulele to scale that you can actually tune, and if you get 3 or 4 people, you can make a chord and even play it.
How wide is the neck on this 13-foot?
It's pretty big. He carries it around in the back of this cool old Chevy pickup truck from the 60s, and it'll be down there. People can come up, take pictures with it, try to play it. It's going to be a whole lot of fun with that.
Steve, there's a world of difference between a string bass and a ukulele. Do you play the ukulele as well?
I play
well?
The ukulele also. They everything has 4 strings, so it all works out just fine. 4 fingers on the left hand, 4 strings. It all works out.
What inspired you to start this in the first place, Ben?
Well, in 2011, there was a documentary made in 2010 called Mighty Uke, The Amazing Journey of a Musical Underdog.
The comeback of the musical underdog.
The filmmakers, Tony Coleman and Margaret Maher from Toronto, came in to show the movie. And we had a lot of fun. We showed the movie. We jammed, had a good time. And I thought, oh, that was great. It went really well. And then people were like, well, what are you going to do next year? And I was like, next year? And ever since then, it's just this festival has grown and grown over the years. And now it's really turned into a nice program to help raise some money for school programs and other music programs in the community.
So when the music is happening in Old Town, where is it actually happening?
It's all over the place. The Sir Pizza in Old Town is kind of the epicenter of Mighty Uke Day. And we're going to have open mic there over at actually the epicenter of Worship Church, which used to be North Presbyterian on the corner of Washington and Grand River. That's where the main concerts and other performances during the day. Then we have group jam sessions in different spots around Old Town.
Okay.
Pruce Pets over in Old Town, too, will be the location for a children's workshop,
yeah.
too. We'll be having a free children's workshop, which I'll be helping facilitate over there.
Okay. We're talking with the man behind Mighty Uke Day in Old Town Lansing this weekend, Ben Hassinger, and his... comrade in crime here, Steve Zalige. Let's talk a little bit about this education effort here. You think that ukuleles can be an important part of music education. How so?
Well, what's nice about the ukulele is you can, one, it's easy to get started on, okay? You can teach an adult or a child 3 two or three chords really within the matter of an hour. You can play and sing at the same time, which is kind of nice. It's hard to do with a recorder or some of the things I grew up with in the music in school. And if you want to get into theory with a trained music teacher, could teach you all the scales and intervals and everything on an ukulele. It's all right there, right at your fingertips.
It's kind of a stringed version of a recorder, really, when you think about it. I mean, it's more manageable for a young player.
I think so. Yeah. And the fact that you can sing and play along together with it, I think, makes a big difference.
Yeah. Steve, we'll ask you to retake your position at your base here, if you don't mind, because these guys are going to play us out. We'll remind everybody the ukulele strum is at the state capitol at noon. The March to Old Town, music till 11 on Friday night, music 10 a.m. to midnight on Saturday, and then an acoustic concert at the Micah Gallery Sunday from 1 to 3 for Mother's Day. I'll remind our listeners that tomorrow on Current State, you know the old phrase, April showers bring May flowers. Well, it turns out it might be the other way around. A new study from U of M suggests that pollen could play a role in the formation of rain. We'll have more. Plus, Lansing Americana band Jackalope joins us in studio S tomorrow for some live music to tell us how they came up with that crazy name. That and more tomorrow on Current State. We hope to see you then. Thank you for listening. Ben Hassinger and Steve Zaligi play us out on Current State.